Okay, this is Bio 241, and we got a couple little slides to talk about in Chapter 4, and then we're going to start talking about Chapter 5 today. So this is February 17th, and let's see, I think last Thursday the lab got their test back to look at your tests, and then so today the other lab will get their test back, and you can review your tests, look at your Scantron. But remember, once we pass a Scantron out to somebody, it can't be regraded. So if you spindled, mutilated, or somehow marked it with stray marks, sit down with your lab instructor and go over it with your lab instructor without taking it away, and then, you know, they can regrade it for you. But if you take it and look at the answer key and then come back on Thursday and say, hey, you got to regrade my Scantron, I can't do that, right? So make sure you know what you're doing before you take your Scantron back. And you can't take any notes on the test either. All right, so I want it to be a learning experience. I want you to look over your Scantron and the test, but we got to maintain the integrity of that test in case I ever want to use it again, right? Okay. So does anybody have any questions over Chapter 4 so far? No? All right. Well, I want to finish up just a couple little concepts. What's the most important energy molecule in your body that you use all the time? ATP, right. So we got ATP. And ATP, when it is hydrolyzed, what do you get from that reaction when you hydrolyze ATP? You get AADP, I like that, plus inorganic phosphate. I'm just going to abbreviate it, PI. And should we stop there? Not really in this chapter, because in this chapter we also want to talk about energy. And maybe somebody had a nice comment. What else should I put on here? Yeah, plus what? Energy. Okay, and we know that this reaction can go backwards and forwards in our body. Okay. So as it's written, though, on the board, is this an exergonic or an endergonic reaction? It's an exergonic reaction because it's releasing energy, right? And how much ATP do you need in your body every day? That's about half your body weight, right? So you need to regenerate that ATP constantly. So in order to generate ATP, what do you need? You need ADP, inorganic phosphate, and what else? You need energy from some other chemical source, like, for instance, glucose. We're going to see that glucose is a very important energy molecule for making more ATP. So going back the other direction, all right, so if this is exergonic, going from ATP to ADP, all right, what is going from ADP back to ATP? What's that? What kind of reaction is that? That's an endergonic reaction because it what? It requires energy. All right, so I think what we have on this slide right here, where's my little marker? What we have on this slide right here, all right, think in terms of this, the chemical reaction that I have on the board. All right, okay, so an exergonic reaction breaks down ATP, and that energy, oh, I need my laser pointer, this energy that's released can be used for your metabolic processes, like to think a thought, contract a muscle, right, or move things around inside the cell that are active processes, pumps, running pumps. Oh, you know what, as a matter of fact, I might as well tell you what the most energy demanding system in your body is. Most of the ATP that you utilize in your body is just to run the sodium potassium ATP pump in all your cells because they're actively working. All right, so it's not muscle contraction, it's not thinking, it's just to run the sodium potassium ATP pump is what requires most of the energy. All right, so here we see an endergonic reaction going from reactant to products. All right, so which reaction is that I have on the board? The little wheel on the right-hand side is which reaction with ATP? Is it going from left to right or right to left? It's going from right to left. All right, so taking reactants, ADP and inorganic phosphate, and making ATP out of it, that's an endergonic reaction, and that can only happen when what happens? When that reaction is coupled with other reactions that are even more exothermic than the synthesis of ADP is what? Endergonic. Otherwise, it just won't happen. So that's where this last statement comes from. It says, most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP, which is what? That is this, does that look like a nice big blue gear right here, the blue gear, right? And is that an exergonic reaction? Sure. That's, and the size of the wheel represents the amount of energy or the quantity of energy. So all of metabolism, which are highly exergonic, are coupled to the reaction for taking ADP, inorganic phosphate, and making ATP out of it so that that ATP can be used in your system. So that's where this statement comes from. All right, so do you see how reactions can be coupled together? Exergonic and endergonic reactions are coupled together to make ATP. Okay, so here is what ATP looks like. And you can see this is just a nice ribo sugar right here. And here is adenine and the three phosphates. And these little squiggles right here represent what kind of bond? What kind of bonds are you familiar with? You have? Give me a kind of a bond. How about a van der Waals force? That's a kind of bond. Okay, hydrogen bond, that's another kind of bond. What are some other kinds of bonds that you're aware of? Ionic bonds and covalent bonds. These squiggles right here are signifying that they are high energy bonds, so that when it is broken, when it is hydrolyzed, that releases a lot of energy. So what kind of bond, all right, releases a lot of energy of those four that we mentioned? Covalent, ionic, hydrogen, or van der Waals forces? Okay. The covalent is the strongest kind of bond, therefore that has the highest energy content. So these are both covalent bonds, but even higher energy than normal, so that when they're broken, that energy is released. All right, so going from adenosine diphosphate and inorganic phosphate to ATP, you should always think of that as what kind of reaction? That's an, in terms of thermodynamics, that is an endergonic reaction. And if you're going to make this ATP, right, it's going to require energy. And where does this energy come from? What's on the previous slide? Most exergonic reactions in your body that release energy, okay, can be used to make ATP. Okay, well, before we start talking about metabolism and reactions, let's foreshadow some things that we'll be looking at. There's something called, well, we looked at a hydrolysis reaction. What's the counterpart to a hydrolysis reaction? It's a dehydration synthesis reaction, all right? Well, here's another kind of reaction that's used in many places of your body. It's called an oxidation reduction reaction, and these two first sentences, you know what? Actually, this whole slide probably you should just memorize. Right? Make sure you can memorize it, maybe write it down, because a lot of students get confused with these oxidation reduction reactions. But I think if you are just familiar with the basic definition, you can figure your way through the situation. Right? So I always like to think in terms of electrons, in terms of oxidation reduction reactions. Your book sometimes talks about hydrogen ions or protons, but I always like to think about electrons. All right, so if a molecule gains electrons, it becomes reduced. All right, so if a molecule somehow receives an electron, it becomes reduced. All right, but where does it get that electron from? From another molecule someplace, right? And so the molecule that gives up that electron is what we call oxidized. All right, so in order for something to become reduced, what has to happen? Another molecule has to become oxidized. So any kind of reaction that has to do with transfer of electrons, we always recognize it as an oxidation reduction reaction, because it takes two molecules, one will be reduced while the other becomes oxidized. Right, and you should be familiar with, I'll tell you which reactions you have to become familiar with to know. Okay, so a reducing agent is something that donates electrons, right, because it's going to reduce some other molecule someplace in your body, right, and a reducing agent through this chemical process right here is the one that becomes oxidized. All right, so the way to think about this is, I don't know, it's, you have to do some gymnastics in your mind, right? But the thing that you should memorize are what? These first two statements right here for sure. All right, so a reducing agent becomes oxidized, so that means an oxidizing agent becomes reduced as a result of this oxidation-reduction reaction. So an oxidizing agent accepts electrons. So oxidation and reduction are always coupled reactions. One cannot happen without the other. And a lot of times, well, you know what, just forget this statement right here. Often involves transfer of hydrogens. You're going to see hydrogens being transferred between molecules as well, but you should just always key on electrons. And coenzymes. What the heck is a coenzyme again? There were coenzyme, and then there was another term on the slide that we introduced at the same time. Cofactor. All right, so you have coenzymes and cofactors. What's a coenzyme? A coenzyme? Okay, a good example would be a vitamin. So what kind of molecule is a vitamin? Is it inorganic or organic? It's a large organic molecule. A vitamin is a large organic molecule. And coenzymes carry metabolites from one set of chemical reactions to another, or from within one place in the cytosol to another place, or from one organelle to another, or maybe from the cytosol into an organelle. But it carries a metabolite, which is another organic molecule. So a coenzyme is an organic molecule that carries other kinds of organic molecules around. Some examples are going to be NAD and FAD. These are also vitamins. And then our last slide shows what they look like. All right, so here's what they look like. You don't have to appreciate these structures right here, but I think if you stare at these, you'll kind of get a nice feel, because what does this look like right here? And what does this look like right here? What does that look like? It looks like, yeah, like an ADP molecule, right? These are just different adenine nucleotides that are incorporated into other larger molecules. So how many of these, this is a dinucleotide, nicotine amide dinucleotide, because I see two nucleotides right here. And in this part of NAD, right in this part of the aromatic ring, it can accept two electrons. All right, and when NAD accepts two electrons, what happens to it? Does it become oxidized or reduced? It becomes reduced. All right, so NAD is the oxidized state of nicotine amide adenine dinucleotide. All right, and we don't draw the other molecule because it's just the same part over here, but if we were to draw it right down over here, that would be okay. So then it becomes NADH. And this is in the reduced state because look what it has gained. It has gained a couple electrons, and here's that hydrogen that was annotated on the previous slide, but here are two electrons. All right, so now what do we have? It's not NAD plus anymore. This is NADH. One of these electrons neutralizes this positive charge, and the other comes along with this hydrogen right here, so NADH is electrically neutral, but it is what? The reduced form of NAD. And NAD plus is the oxidized form. All right, so what do we call that kind of reaction when NAD plus gets converted into NADH? That is an oxidation-reduction reaction, and in particular, NAD plus is reduced to become NADH. All right, and guess what NADH can do? It can now donate those electrons to another set of reactions someplace. So we're going to see where that happens. And these electrons right here carry a lot of energy. So NADH is a high energy intermediate, right, that is carrying these high energy electrons from one chemical set of chemical reactions to another. There's a similar kind of molecule, and that's FAD. And this is what FAD looks like. And you see that it doesn't exist as an ion in the oxidized state. It can accept two electrons and two hydrogen, and it incorporates them at these two nitrogen positions here and here. So it is carrying, again, two high-energy electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another. So we're going to see where these reactions take place. Okay, so when you see this term, NAD plus and FAD, you should recognize these as being as participating in oxidation-reduction reactions. But these are coenzymes that are carrying something important from one set of reactions to another, from one place in the cell to another place. And what are the things that it's carrying around? Think of these two electrons right here, the two electrons. All right, in each case, there's going to be two electrons. All right, and FADH2 is not an ion, because along with the two hydrogens right here, the two hydrogen atoms, or the two, these two protons right here, there is also what? There's an electron in this bond, and there's an electron in this bond. So it remains neutral. Okay, and these are both important vitamins. And you're going to see what chemical reactions they play important roles in. All right, so who's got a question about that? Anybody got a question about any of these slides at all? Okay. All right, so now we go to chapter 5. Cell respiration and metabolism. Okay, so we're going to start by talking about glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and a little bit about fat and protein metabolism. All right, but let's start with some basic definitions first. Metabolism refers to all the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body at one time. So metabolism is all the chemical reactions happening. And we can break down metabolism into two categories. One is catabolism, and the second is anabolism. Catabolism breaks down large molecules and releases energy. All right, do you see anything in the front of the room that looks like a catabolic reaction? When you have a large molecule and you break it down into two smaller ones or more, and it releases energy. Do you see a catabolic reaction anywhere? Yeah, right there on the board. Look, we got ATP. Okay, it gets broken down into ADP, which is smaller, plus inorganic phosphate. That's a small molecule. And what's released? Energy. Energy is a participant in that reaction, right? So that's catabolism of ATP. Okay, and we're going to look at a bunch of catabolic metabolic pathways, right, that is used for making ATP. Right, so that's like those two gears that we saw in that last slide that are coupled together. All right, anabolism, on the other hand, makes larger molecules. And if going in the reverse, ADP plus inorganic phosphate can be used to make ATP as long as you have what else going along with it? Energy. Right, so anabolism requires energy in order for it to take place. So okay, so that produces the energy storage compounds in our body, like ATP. All right, so here is just a nice overview of metabolism that we're going to look at in this chapter, and you might want to refer to this picture a bunch of times. So, for instance, we're going to see that a very important energy molecule in our body is glucose, right? And glucose is metabolized by four main kinds of metabolic reactions in our body. Well, how do our cells get glucose? Well, it could come from our diet, right? If we eat something, we absorb glucose from our digestive tract, and then glucose is absorbed. We looked at the absorption processes using co-transport and things like that in the GLUT4 transporters. It goes from our circulatory system, right, into cells, and in order for cells to take up glucose, they need an insulin passport to activate those GLUT4 transporters. Glucose enters the cytoplasm. But when you're in a fasted state, you don't have glucose being absorbed from the digestive tract. Your blood glucose is going to decrease, but there is an organ right here, namely your liver, that has a store of glucose in it in the form of glycogen. So glycogen is a polysaccharide made up of glucose, right? Thousands of units of glucose. So when you're in a fasted state, glucose will break glycogen down and put glucose into the blood to keep your blood glucose concentration within a normal range. And that glucose can enter the cell. So this is the fed state. This right here represents the fasted state, fed versus fasted state. All right, so what are these catabolic reactions? And why do we say catabolic? Here we have glucose. Can anybody remember how many carbon atoms glucose has in it? It has six. And what else does it have? It's got six waters on each one of those carbons, right? It's C6H12O6. All right. And what is the result of all of these reactions right here? You get carbon dioxide and water. So what kind of reaction is this? Glucose going all the way to carbon dioxide and water. Is that an anabolic reaction or a catabolic reaction? That's a catabolic reaction, all right, and that's going to release energy because all of the covalent bonds between the carbon atoms in glucose have a lot of energy. So this is a nice catabolic pathway releasing energy while your cells are producing CO2 and water. And guess what your cells do with all of this energy that's being released? It couples these reactions to make, and this is really the whole point of everything that we're going to look at in this chapter, what does your cell do with all of this energy right here? It makes something out of it. It makes ATP, right? It makes ATP. So these are the exergonic reactions that we've been talking about that is used to make ATP, right? Because in order to make ATP, don't forget that is an endergonic reaction that has to be coupled with exergonic reactions to take place. All right, so what is the first exergonic pathway? So we're not going to study in detail these different pathways, but it's more than just one reaction. It's a series of enzymatic reactions. All right, is glucose being converted into pyruvic acid, and that's what we call glycolysis. This happens not in an organelle, but just in the cytosol someplace. Your book says cytoplasm, but just know that that's cytoplasm officially contains organelles as well, but in this particular case, right, we really mean cytosol. These enzymes that break glucose down into pyruvate happen in the cytosol. So what does glycolysis mean? What does lysis mean? Yeah, to split something, right? Just to split. And glucose has six carbon atoms. Pyruvic acid or pyruvate has three carbon atoms. So this process, glycolysis, basically does what? Takes a pair of scissors and chops glucose right in the middle in half, and so you end up with two pyruvate molecules. And that's what we call glycolysis, happens in the cytoplasm. Now here is a branch point, depending on whether there is oxygen present or not within the cell. If there is no oxygen present, pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid, and we call this anaerobic respiration because anaerobic means without oxygen. And this happens in numerous kinds of tissues, probably mostly in the heart. It can happen maybe in the brain to some extent and skeletal muscle. And we'll see why this happens, but basically this process right here is to produce ATP, right? That's the whole point of this. And we'll see what happens to lactic acid. But if there is oxygen present in cells, then there is an organelle that can function. And that functioning organelle is the mitochondria. And you learned pretty much what is the job of the mitochondria. It is to make ATP, right? So this is a very efficient process. So the second chemical reaction takes pyruvic acid and after it enters the mitochondria, it converts it into a form that can enter the Krebs cycle. We call that a preparatory reaction. So there's a preparatory reaction right here. Then the Krebs cycle can help make some ATP. And then intermediates of the Krebs cycle can transfer things to the electron transport chain for the synthesis of ATP. And this is all relies on mitochondria having oxygen. So all of these reactions right here we call aerobic respiration. And the end result of that is not lactic acid, but how many CO2s are made for every glucose? There's got to be 6, right? Because there were 6 carbon atoms in glucose, so it's going to produce 6 CO2s, right? And water is also going to be produced as a result of that. All right, so refer to this slide a number of times when we're looking at respiration, cellular respiration. And also on this slide, now you see that there are 2 forms of cellular respiration, and they are called anaerobic respiration versus aerobic respiration. One happens in the cytosol, and the other happens in the mitochondria. Okay? All right, so we're going to look in some detail in these chemical reactions right here, and we're going to start with glycolysis. And what is glycolysis again? Just kind of say in your mind, glycolysis. What molecule enters glycolysis? It is glucose, and what's the end molecule going to be? It's going to be pyruvate, as a matter of fact, 2 pyruvate molecules. Okay. So, yeah. Oh, the 4 ways. First way is glycolysis. Okay. The second way is preparatory reaction. Preparatory reaction takes pyruvate and lets it enter the Krebs cycle. That's the second way. That's a preparatory reaction. The third way is Krebs cycle. And the fourth way is electron transport. So I'll say that again. First way is glycolysis. Second way is preparatory reaction. Third way is Krebs cycle. Fourth way is electron transport. So that's what we're going to describe in a little bit of detail. Okay, and you can see that the preparatory reaction, Krebs cycle, and electron transport are completely dependent on oxygen. Those are aerobic pathways. Glycolysis can take place with or without the presence of oxygen. And so, you know, I consider that part of the anaerobic pathway because there's a little outlet for lactic acid right here. Okay. All right, so glycolysis, that's step number one. Glycolysis, step number one. This is the metabolic pathway by which glucose is converted into 2 pyruvates. Does not require oxygen, and the overall equation is glucose plus 2 NAD. Oh, and what should you put on this NAD right here? Plus sign, right? So 2 NAD plus, that means that it's in the oxidized state, plus 2 ADP plus 2 inorganic phosphate. We split glucose in half, we get 2 pyruvates. We get 2 reduced NADHs right here, plus 2 ATP. All right, so as this equation is written right here, when we split glucose in half, how many ATPs do we get out of it? You get 2. That's better than nothing, but you're going to see that that's not very many ATPs. All right, but that's a good start. All right, so let's look at this. All right, so glycolysis is exergonic. All right, and that energy can be used to produce a net 2 ATPs and 2 NADHs. Now, what are these NADHs carrying around with them? I mentioned this, but maybe it's the first time you heard anybody say anything about NADH. It's carrying 2 high-energy electrons. All right, and sometimes, if the cell conditions are right, these NADHs can be used to make even more ATP. All right, if things are right. If they're not right, then that energy gets lost. All right, however, glucose must be activated before glycolysis can take place, and it's activated with 2 ATPs. We call that phosphorylation. And so that energy is lost. Right? But when glucose is phosphorylated, what can you tell me about this inorganic phosphate right here? What kind of molecule does that look like? Does that have, is it hydrophobic or hydrophilic? It is hydrophilic, right? Because it has a lot of ionization on it, a lot of oxygens with a minus sign. So inorganic phosphate can it move through the cell membrane easily or not if it's hydrophilic? It can't move at all, right? So when glucose enters most cells in the body, it becomes phosphorylated. And so that's a way that cells make sure that that glucose can never, ever leave the cell, because that phosphate can't get through the cell membrane. So here it says that that phosphorylation traps glucose inside the cell. Well, those cells are sort of greedy. They don't want to give up that glucose molecule. And the way to trap it inside the cell is to phosphorylate it. Okay. So here is a diagram of the free energy of various reactants that make up glycolysis versus time, or the process of glycolysis. And you can see glucose by itself, right, it has sort of an intermediate free energy, right? And in order for pyruvate to be made, right, even with these different enzymatic steps, glucose has to be activated, and it takes two ATP. Glucose is going to be phosphorylated on either end of the molecule that traps it inside the cell. And when it is phosphorylated, then it can proceed via the rest of the steps of glycolysis. So between step one, intermediate one and two right here, we see that there is an oxidation reduction reaction that takes place. So NAD plus, two NAD pluses, get converted into two NADHs. Right, so what's being used up in the cell, inside the cytoplasm? The two NADH pluses, right, are being converted into the reduced form, NADHs. And these are carrying those high energy electrons. All right, and two subsequent steps from this reaction right here, between step two and three, we see that two ATPs can be made. Now, why on earth do you see two ATPs right here? Because in this reaction right here, this glucose is split into two, right, into two, three carbon fragments. So glucose is a six carbon fragment. It gets split into two. So for every step, we now have to multiply each intermediate by two, because you have two, three carbon molecules. And then the very last step, again, we see this reaction, right, going from intermediate number three to pyruvic acid, all right, that can make another two ATPs. All right, so characterize this metabolic reaction of this intermediate number one going down to pyruvic acid in terms of its thermodynamics. And look at this arrow over here. What kind of reaction is this? Number one going all the way down to pyruvic acid. That's an exergonic reaction. And what can be coupled with this exergonic reaction? It is the synthesis of ATP, which is what? An endergonic reaction. Okay. All right, so we see that glycolysis produces four ATP, right, and these two NADHs, but what did we need to get glycolysis to work? We needed two ATP, so what's the net ATP that's being produced by glycolysis? It's only two as a result. Okay. So here is what glycolysis really looks like. And I switch back and forth between whether I have the class memorize all of these enzymes and intermediates, and I think last semester I didn't have my class learn it. So that means that you're the class then that has to learn all these intermediate steps in glycolysis. All right, so what do you start with? Glucose. You see it's phosphorylated. All right, and then glucose gets isomerized into fructose. And then you have fructose 1,6 biphosphate, because you have these two phosphates right here. And then what happens to this fructose? It gets chopped in half, okay, to produce these phosphoglyceraldehyde molecules. And going from phosphoglyceraldehyde to biphosphoglyceric acid, that is coupled to an oxidation reduction reaction. And then here's a couple other reactions, and you can see that it is coupled with the synthesis of two ATP molecules. Okay, well, I changed my mind about having you know all of the intermediate steps on this reaction and the names of the enzymes. But what do you have to know? You got to know where this metabolic pathway takes place, okay, what the input molecule is, and what is produced by glycolysis, and the overall net reaction in terms of energy intermediates. So what would you say as far as energy intermediates are? What would you say? One, two ATPs, right? Three, four ATPs, but don't forget we had to use two up at the very beginning. So only two ATPs are produced, but also two NADHs are produced. And what's being carried around on these NADHs? High energy electrons, right? And how do we characterize a molecule that carries something around from one set of reactions to another? It's a coenzyme, right? And NAD is what? A big, large organic molecule. All right, so this is glycolysis. The other thing you got to know is, where does this take place? In the cytosol. And can this happen without oxygen? Absolutely it can. Okay. All right, let's talk about Le Chatelier's principle. What's another name for Le Chatelier's principle? It's the law of mass action, right? Okay. The law of mass action says, what if pyruvate builds up inside the cell, and what if ATP builds up inside the cell? What's going to happen to glycolysis? It's going to have a tendency to go back the other way, right? And as the cell uses up ATP and pyruvic acid goes away, what happens to glycolysis? It goes in the forward direction, right? So you could think of glycolysis as running either forwards and backwards, and you can even see the two little lines right here. One's a dotted line and one's a solid line. All right, so which line, the dotted or the solid, represents glycolysis? The solid, right, going from glucose to pyruvate. The dotted line means going back the opposite way, and I'll tell you what that is, but don't think about it too much right at the moment. You have to be familiar with it sooner or later, right? That is the production of glucose from pyruvic acid. We call that gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis. All right, so I'll mention that again later on in the chapter and even the subsequent chapters. Yeah. Oh, you know what? Let me do that. I do have it. All right, so glycolysis is glucose to pyruvate, gluconeogenesis. What does that neo mean? It means new, right? And genesis means the making of new glucose from those intermediates right there. Okay, that's gluconeogenesis. Is the reverse of glycolysis. The sign-in sheet for today is right here. Okay, if you're not on this list, you're probably in trouble. I don't know, because that's an official registration. Okay, so we're still talking about anaerobic respiration. Okay, so to avoid end product inhibition, well, I tell you what, let's go back to this one right here. So what would you think is one of the main points of glycolysis is to produce ATP, right? Because your cells are using up ATP all the time. So ATP is not going to have a tendency to build up inside the cell because you're going to use it for that energy purposes right away. But nonetheless, right, if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, that's going to force glycolysis to run in the reverse direction. When glycolysis runs in the reverse direction, what happens to the production of ATP? Which glycolysis can only make ATP when it's running in the forward direction, right? If it runs in the reverse direction, those cells can't make ATP. What's going to happen to a cell if it can't make ATP? It's going to die, right? That's not a good thing. All right, so we don't want pyruvic acid to build up inside the cell. What other molecule builds up inside the cell if glycolysis is operating? Okay, almost lactic acid. We're going to get to that next. This is a reason for why cells produce lactic acid. All right, ATP, we don't have to worry about ATP because a cell is going to use it up if it's alive. But what else accumulates in this process right here if glycolysis is operating in the forward direction? look at this. NADH also builds up inside the cell. And if NADH builds up inside the cell, guess what happens to glycolysis? It gets forced back the opposite direction, or it gets stopped. Right? And when glycolysis gets stopped, what happens to ATP production? It stops. What happens to the cell? It dies, right? All right, so the cell has to do something with this NAD because of Le Chatelier's principle. It's going to stop glycolysis. But the other thing is, you also need what? You need NAD plus in order for glycolysis to proceed in the forward direction. So two reasons why the cell has to do something with NADH, and that is this reaction right here, the lactic acid pathway. This is the last part of the anaerobic respiration pathway. All right, so to avoid end product inhibition, NADHs produced in glycolysis need to what? To be oxidized. They need to go back to NAD+. So in the absence of oxygen, this pyruvic acid sort of gets trapped inside the cell. It cannot go into the mitochondria. Let me flip back to that first slide again, and then I'll flip back. All right, so pyruvic acid, under anaerobic conditions, cannot enter the mitochondria. Pyruvic acid is going to build up inside the cell. NADH is going to build up inside the cell. So there has to be this outlet right here. That's the lactic acid pathway. So what does that lactic acid pathway do? Forward. No, back. Okay. So here is the end product of glycolysis. And it gets converted into lactic acid via this lactate dehydrogenase. And in order for that to happen, NAD has to donate electrons to pyruvic acid and convert it into lactic acid. Right? This lactic acid now can leave the cell. So what happens to the concentration of pyruvic acid under anaerobic conditions inside the cell? Can it build up? This prevents the buildup of pyruvic acid inside the cell because lactic acid leaves. And when pyruvic acid concentration decreases, what happens to glycolysis? If pyruvic acid, right, it goes away, what happens to glycolysis? It can still function. And when glycolysis functions, what's being produced? ATP. So the lactic acid pathway is a way to maintain glycolysis so that cells still can get some ATP through this anaerobic pathway. And what else happens? What gets regenerated? NAD plus gets regenerated, right? And is NAD plus important for glycolysis? Sure, right? And this step right here, you need NAD plus in order for glycolysis to work in the forward direction. So the lactic acid pathway, right, just as a way to keep glycolysis working so that cells don't run out of ATP. So we call that the anaerobic respiration, or sometimes we call that fermentation. I think did you guys do a yeast experiment already in lab? No? Not yet? Maybe this week? Okay. So anaerobic respiration or fermentation is this. All right, glucose was what? C6H12O6 going to lactate or lactic acid. And your cells can use that for energy. What kind of energy does your cell get out of that? How many ATPs? Plus 2 ATPs. Okay. You're going to see another fermentation pathway, and maybe some of you have thought about this fermentation pathway. Maybe some of you have thought about it a lot. We got C6H12O6. All right, so this is us, humans. All right, how many carbons are in lactic acid? There's 3. How many carbons are in pyruvate? 3. It's the same, right? There's only a difference in this number of protons and electrons between pyruvic and lactic acid. Other organisms can operate anaerobically, and they produce this kind of reaction. CH3CH2OH plus CO2. What does this look like? Okay. You got an OH right here. What kind of group is that? That's a hydroxyl group. So this is ethyl alcohol. Anybody know anything about ethyl alcohol? No, not a thing, probably. Okay, I'm kidding you, because this is what? This is what's in adult beverages. This is ethyl alcohol. Okay, yeah, so you said that, but you're a little too shy to tell me. Right, but so this is what's in what? Wine and beer, all right, and other distilled kind of spirits. And so you can see what? Two carbons right here. Where's the third carbon? It goes in, it makes CO2, right? So that's what gives bubbles to champagne and beer and things like that. So this is what we call a yeast fermentation or alcohol fermentation. All right, now why do we call both of these fermentation reactions? What's that? What does that mean? That really means fermentation is a chemical reaction that happens anaerobically, without oxygen, okay? And alcohol fermentation, because it produces alcohol. This is a lactate fermentation because it produces lactic acid, okay? Now, so this happens in, for instance, yeast, which we use all the time to bake bread, for instance, because we like, what happens to bread when we bake it? It expands, it rises because of this CO2 over here, right? But it also produces a little bit of alcohol, but that's so volatile when you have it in the oven, it just evaporates out of the bread. So no one ever gets drunk by eating bread. All right. But now why in humans do we have lactate fermentation but not alcohol fermentation? Okay, why do we have this pathway and not this pathway? Because this pathway produces ethyl alcohol, and what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol? It's toxic. Right, it intoxicates people that drink it. So if your body were to produce it, right, it's toxic to our brains, and it would decrease our brain function. We couldn't even find our way to school. Okay, and how would you get drunk? How would you get drunk if we had alcohol dehydrogenase in our bodies? That enzyme working out, sure, holding your breath. Right? Just by decreasing oxygen concentration, deferring to anaerobic metabolism, right, we would intoxicate ourselves. So mammals, because we have a nervous system, we don't produce that enzyme. We don't produce alcohol dehydrogenase. Our bodies produce what? Lactate dehydrogenase, because that's not a toxic compound to our nervous system. All right, so that's an important pathway that you should know about. Okay, but in general, why do we have that lactic acid pathway? In general, why? What's the purpose of the lactic acid pathway? What's the purpose? Okay, yeah, that's a nice specific reason, but we have a lactic acid pathway to keep what operating? To keep glycolysis operating in our cells under anaerobic conditions. Right, and the reason why it keeps glycolysis working is because it gets rid of pyruvic acid, so you don't have end product inhibition. It regenerates NAD+, so that glycolysis still can proceed in the forward direction. Okay, that's why we have the lactic acid pathway. So I think this maybe right here is an important reaction for you to know. All right, so that lactic acid pathway only produces 2 ATPs per glucose. That might be enough to keep some cells alive. All right, so I don't want to quibble too much about just 2 ATPs. Red blood cells don't have any mitochondria. As a matter of fact, red blood cells don't have any organelles at all. They don't have a nucleus. They don't need a lot of energy because they're loaded with hemoglobin that passively carries oxygen around in our blood. It needs some ATP to keep the sodium-potassium pumps working in those cells. And the way that red blood cells produce ATP is only via the lactic acid pathway or through glycolysis, right? This can also happen in skeletal muscle and heart muscle when oxygen supply falls below a critical level, or during heavy exercise, or when there's a vascular blockage to some part of your body. All right, but your heart, since skeletal muscle, I suppose, when you cut off blood supply to it, if you relax it, glycolysis can maintain the health of that muscle. But does your heart ever take a break? Can it ever take a break? It can't. It needs a lot more ATP than what can be generated through glycolysis. So if there is a blockage of blood to the heart, even though it can operate a certain period of time anaerobically, that part of the heart is still going to die anyway because it needs a whole lot more ATP, because what's it doing all the time? It's contracting, using ATP up. Okay, so the heart and the kidney and the brain are very sensitive to oxygen concentrations. They can't function without aerobic respiration. All right, so for osmotic reasons, cells can't store many free glucoses. Maybe a cell would want to store 10,000 molecules of glucose just to have it on hand. What's going to happen to water as a cell accumulates 10,000 molecules of glucose? What's going to happen to the shape of that cell? It's going to draw water in because glucose can't leave, right? So that cell is going to swell up, right? That's an osmotic reason why glucose, when it's stored, is stored in the form of glycogen, right? And as you take those 10,000 particles of glucose and form one molecule out of it, what happens to the tonicity of the cell? It doesn't change, right? So it doesn't draw water into the cell. So that's why glucose is stored as glycogen. So glycogen is, how would you tell me something about glycogen? It is? Yeah, it's a polymer of glucose, right? It's made out of many glucose molecules. It's made by, what, dehydration synthesis reactions? It's a polysaccharide, right? Glycogen is a polysaccharide made up of just glycogen. So glycogenesis, right? Can you see glycogen right here? What is glycogen? Glycogen is a big polymer of glucose. And genesis is what? The making of glycogen. So glycogenesis is when we take monosaccharides of glucose and join them together via dehydration synthesis to make glycogen. All right, that's glycogenesis. All right, so muscles store glycogen for when they start exercising heavily. What other organ stores a lot of glycogen? It doesn't contract, but the liver, right, stores glycogen. So when you're in a fasted state, it breaks that glycogen down and can put those glucose molecules back in your blood when you're in a fasted state to maintain glucose levels. All right, so glycogenesis is the production of glycogen. And when you're in a fasted state or when muscles are exercising, right, then the reverse process happens. The reverse process is called glycogenolysis, the breaking down of glycogen. Right, so this clips glucose out of a glycogen as glucose 6-phosphate, and then that cell can utilize it. If it's a muscle cell, liver is the only kind of organ that has a phosphatase that can dephosphorylate this glucose 6-phosphate, and then glucose can actually leave the liver because it doesn't have that hydrophilic molecule bound to it, preventing it from leaving the molecule. All right, so what do we have? Let me see what this next slide looks like. All right, so here we have glucose. This is an okay slide. All right, what do we call that pathway of going from glucose all the way down to pyruvate? That's glycolysis. All right, what do we call pyruvate going back up to glucose? That is gluconeogenesis. What do we call the metabolic pathway where glucose is used to make glycogen? That would be like pathway number one right here. That is glycogenesis. And then what do we call that process of glycogen being used to make glucose? That is glycogenolysis. All right, so you got four terms that you should be able to spell, and for sure by next time, spell them out a number of times, and I've actually had some students that never learned the difference between glycogenolysis and glycolysis and glycogenesis, and you just got to be really familiar with these things because that's important for us to understand, for instance, diabetes. Has anybody heard of diabetes? Oh, yeah, it's a really important disease, right? And you just won't have a clue on how to treat patients unless you understand these metabolic processes, okay? All right, so what are these processes again? We got glycolysis. Here's table 5.1. We got glycolysis, conversion of glucose into 2-pyruvate. Glycogenesis. What's glycogenesis? That's the synthesis of glycogen. That's taking glucoses and putting them together. Right? Glycogenolysis. That's the breaking down of glycogen. And gluconeogenesis is, yeah, that's the when you take pyruvate and make a glucose molecule out of it. Okay? All right. A couple other terms right here. Lipogenesis. Right, from what you learned, that is what. So, what is a lipid again? Lipid is a fat, right? That's the making of fat. That's a formation of triglycerides. Lipolysis is what? The reverse of lipogenesis. That's the breakdown of lipids. Okay, and we can use that to make energy. And ketogenesis. This is an interesting kind of term right here. Ketogenesis. All right, is when your body makes ketone bodies or ketones, and that usually happens as a result of lipolysis. All right, so I'll say some more about ketogenesis later on, maybe not right now. Okay. All right, so here's a cell. Let's look at this slide again. Here's a cell that can take up glucose. And here we see it gets phosphorylated. So what can you tell me about this glucose 6-phosphate that's inside the cell? It's trapped inside the cell, right? So it can't leave. And glucose 6-phosphate can be used to make glycogen via what? What's that process again? Number one is called glycogen and genesis. All right, this glucose right here can also be used for glycolysis to make ATP. And one organ has a phosphatase. What kind of enzyme is a phosphatase again? It removes a phosphate molecule, right? So a phosphatase, glucose 6-phosphatase takes that phosphate off of glucose 6-phosphate, and now glucose can actually leave and go back into the blood, and that only happens in the liver. All other cells that glucose is trapped for its energy metabolism. All right, so the liver is the only organ that can secrete glucose because it has glucose 6-phosphatase, that enzyme. Okay, so here's the Cori cycle. This will give us some practice on naming these metabolic pathways again. Okay, this is the Cori cycle. So here we have skeletal muscles. And over here we have the liver. And what can you tell me about glucose and skeletal muscles? Can glucose ever leave a skeletal muscle cell? No, it gets trapped. It can't leave. But what about the liver? The liver can secrete glucose because it has the phosphatase enzyme. Muscle cells don't have the glucose 6-phosphatase, so once glucose enters, it can never leave. All right, so here we have a muscle. And here's a glucose, it's been phosphorylated. When the muscle is not contracting, how much energy does it need? It needs a little bit, not a lot, right? If it contracts, it needs a lot of energy, all right? So when this muscle is exercising, this glucose is going to be converted into pyruvic acid. What's this pathway called? Glucose to pyruvate, that's glycolysis. The muscle is contracting. And fortunately, glycolysis makes ATP for the cell. And when a muscle is contracting, right, it can be operating anaerobically. So pyruvate then gets converted to lactic acid. So what's the beauty of that? Why does pyruvic acid get converted into lactic acid in an exercising muscle? Yeah, it's just to make sure that glycolysis keeps working in the forward direction, right? So pyruvate gets used up and NAD plus gets regenerated so glycolysis can operate. And that's important because that's where ATP is coming from. Right, that lactic acid can leave the cell. But remember, this glucose-6-phosphate can't. Lactic acid can leave the cell, go into the blood, and where does it go? It can go to the liver right here. And the liver, all right, has oxygen. And then it can convert lactic acid back to pyruvic acid, and then pyruvic acid gets rebuilt into glucose. All right, so what is this path, number six, what is this pathway right here? This is gluconeogenesis, right, the making of new glucose from pyruvate. And number five right here is just what the lactate dehydrogenase enzyme that's running in the reverse direction. And that glucose then can be recycled, right, back via the blood to the muscle to give energy to this particular muscle right here. But don't forget, going from pyruvic acid to glucose, that's going to take ATP to do that. So that puts a metabolic burden on the liver to undergo gluconeogenesis. Right, so this is what we call the Cori cycle. Now, when the muscle's, let's just say when the muscle is exercising, the muscle can get its own glucose by what process? Going from glycogen to glucose-6-phosphate. What is this process? That is, glycolysis is going from glucose to pyruvate. Okay, glucose to pyruvate is glycolysis. Glycogenolysis is going from glycogen to glucose. All right, so that's when the cell is, when the muscle is exercising. All right, when it's at rest, what happens? Well, glucose in the muscle gets converted to glycogen. That is what? Glycogenesis. All right, the liver doesn't have to help out either when the muscle is resting, so it's going to convert glucose to glycogen. That is glycogenesis in the liver as well. Okay. So this is probably a pretty important figure to appreciate. So what are these four terms that you should be familiar with? All right, how about glycolysis? What's that? Glycolysis is glucose to pyruvate. Okay, so I abbreviated that. What's another one? How about, okay, let's see if I can get this straight. How about glycogenesis. What's glycogenesis? Glucose to glycogen. All right, what's another term? We got glycolysis. How about gluconeogenesis? Is pyruvate to glucose. We need one more. How about glycogenolysis? Glycogenolysis is the breaking down of glycogen. That is what? Glycogen to glucose. All right, so those are those four terms. So you got to make sure that you can spell them out, okay, and pronounce them out so that you have some kind of picture in your mind of where the pathways are going. Okay? All right. Gluconeogenesis. All right, and to some extent, this can also happen with some amino acids and glycerol. All right. Well, let me introduce aerobic respiration. All right, so that's anaerobic respiration. All right, let me go back to this real quick. If somebody has diabetes and their blood glucose is way too high, let's think of maybe some ways that we can help that patient out. Of course, we're going to tell them to do what with glucose in their diet? Okay? Yeah, to lower glucose in their diet. That's going to lower their blood glucose. But what else could be used to lower their blood glucose? Okay, by giving insulin. Yeah, by having glucose being taken up by this muscle cell right here. All right, but look, this liver is still going to produce glucose via, what is this pathway? Gluconeogenesis, and also via glycogenolysis. So we might want to come up with some pharmaceutical agents that are going to inhibit gluconeogenesis or glycogenolysis, right? Because that's going to end up putting glucose in the blood. And so those are the other treatments that have been designed to help somebody with diabetes. Because not only does glucose come from your diet, but it is also made by your body. Okay, so working. Oh, that's wonderful. Because what does glucose in the blood need in order to get into this cell right here? It needs insulin, right? And insulin is just a hormone. It needs a cell surface receptor right here. Okay, and if your body isn't producing insulin, that glucose can't get in. That's a type 1 type diabetes. If you have normal insulin but the receptor is not working properly, that's a type 2 diabetes. Glucose still can't get into the cell even though you have normal insulin levels. So these muscle cells, as a matter of fact, most cells in your body are what? They're starving to death because there's plenty of glucose in your body, but it's trapped in the blood. It can't get inside the cells. But now what you mentioned is fantastic. Because when you exercise a skeletal muscle, that also puts in the GLUT4 transporters, and that allows glucose to enter muscle cells even though, all right, there's no insulin signal, or maybe some of the receptors for insulin are not working. So exercise is an important treatment for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes because it allows glucose to enter the cells. So exercise is real important. So what are the two things if somebody has some kind of disease process that we always say, and this is the reason why people just hate physiology classes, including me, because what are two ways that you can help yourself? Diet and exercise, right? Diet and exercise. And diabetes is certainly another pathology that is helped by both of those as well. Decrease glucose in your diet and exercise. Okay, aerobic respiration. Where does aerobic respiration take place? Let's go about all the way back. All right, so we just got done talking about glycolysis and the lactate pathway right here and how you can even go backwards right through those other processes. So now we're going to talk about aerobic respiration and where does it take place? Inside the mitochondria. And what is necessary for these mitochondria to operate properly? They need oxygen, right? So without oxygen, pyruvic acid cannot even enter the mitochondria, can't even get in, right? It just gets shunted over to lactic acid. So the three remaining pathways that we're interested in is the preparatory reaction, the Krebs cycle, and the electron transport, the three remaining reactions. All right, so the preparatory reaction is right here. Right, so it begins when pyruvate formed by glycolysis enters the mitochondria. So here's pyruvic acid. How many carbons do you see in pyruvic acid? There are three. All right, and this last carbon is going to be broken off. All right, and it's going to produce a CO2. The remaining two carbon fragment here is going to be carried within the mitochondria by this thing right here, coenzyme A. Coenzyme is a large organic molecule. Don't even want to show you a picture of it. But because of this, what kind of functional group is this right here? That's a sulfhydryl group. That's a very reactive kind of functional group that will then carry this two carbon fragment to the Krebs cycle. We'll donate that two carbon fragment. And whenever you have a two carbon fragment right there, that's an acetyl group. All right, acetyl is a two-carbon fragment. So you see one, two. Where's the third carbon at? CO2. So this preparatory reaction is a, what is this functional group over here on pyruvic acid? This is a carboxyl group. This is a what? A decarboxylation. All right, it's a decarboxylation reaction. that produces acetyl coenzyme A plus CO2. This is the preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. All right, so what organelle? Well, tell me about CO2 in your body. What do you do with CO2 in your body? That's a reason for exhaling, so that you can excrete it, right, into the air. What organelle produces CO2? The mitochondria produces CO2. As a matter of fact, what chemical reaction produces CO2? You only know one. It is what? The preparatory reaction, right? When acetyl coenzyme A is created from pyruvic acid with the help of coenzyme A. What's the function of a coenzyme again? It carries something around from one set of reactions to another. NADH is carrying what? Electrons. Acetyl coenzyme A is carrying an acetyl group, right? It's a two-carbon fragment. It's not carrying electrons around. Also, in this preparatory reaction, we see that in the mitochondria, there is also an oxidation reduction reaction taking place. And NAD, don't forget that little plus right here, gets converted into NADH. So in the back of your mind, and it's color-coded a little bit differently right here, this NADH is carrying what? High-energy electrons, right? And this acetyl coenzyme A is carrying some high energy in the form of this acetyl group. And this acetyl group is going to be donated to the Krebs cycle. And the last reaction that we see right up over here, aerobic respiration, these are where the electrons from NADH end up. All right, so the acetyl group goes into the Krebs cycle, but those electrons from NADH end up in, electron transport, right up over here. Let's see if I need to say anything else yet today. Probably not too much, except, you know, we're going to start with this reaction next time. So what is this membrane right here? This is the mitochondrial membrane, and we can see pyruvate entering the mitochondria. Under what conditions can pyruvate enter the mitochondria? Aerobic conditions, right? And immediately becomes decarboxylated, and that two-carbon fragment then is attached to coenzyme A, becoming acetyl coenzyme A. That's going to produce some CO2, which you breathe out of your body. And also in the process, it forms some high-energy electrons that are carried by NADH. All right, NADH is going to go to the electron transport chain, but this acetyl group enters the Krebs cycle. So here is the last intermediate in the Krebs cycle. It has four carbons on it. So if we have a four-carbon molecule and we add two carbons to it, what do we end up with? A six-carbon unit right here. All right, and then through the turning of this Krebs cycle, right, if we have six carbon over here and then we end up with four, that means how many carbons we have to lose through the Krebs cycle? We got to lose two, and here's where the other two carbon atoms from glucose end up as carbon dioxide, right, within the Krebs cycle. And we're going to see the Krebs cycle produces some ATP, but even more importantly, it produces some high-energy electrons. And what metabolic pathway can use those high-energy electrons to make ATP? It is, electron transport chain. All right, so that's kind of everything in a nutshell, but we're going to look at aerobic respiration in a little bit more detail next time. Okay. I maybe did. I'll do that.